Hello, this is Tom Paulkin, Chairman of the Texas Workforce Commission. Did you know that 0.058% of the nation's workforce are in the field of journalism? That's up from a whopping 0.055% back in 2000. So here's one of the few and the proud, your host, Mr. Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton, one of the proud 0.5% here with the Tribcast for the second week of April. Joining me is Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Hey, Reeve. No, I'm just thinking, there's a joke about you being fired in there somewhere, because he's talking about people who are employed in journalism, which, from your standpoint, I would just say, don't get comfortable.
You would never do that.
Are you talking to me or Evan?
Evan.
Executive Editor Ross Ramsey.
Suddenly, a chill came over the room.
sorry to bring the room down, Ross.
That would take it all the way back to 2000 levels if you did that.
That's true.
Reporter Tan Tan is also here.
Hi.
Hello. We are going to be talking about...
You're a very tolerant person to sit in with this group.
I am.
I know.
You should have heard the things she said before we turned the recording button on.
What a potty mouth.
Yeah. We are going to be talking, without expletives, Tan, about Rick Santorum and his departure, schools in Texas, failing schools in Texas specifically, and then we'll be talking about the other thing that we have planned, which we'll get to.
Which you don't remember?
No, last week he did this and we never got to it. He said, well, and there was one other thing we might talk about, and then he said goodbye. And
so you're hedging.
I'm anticipating that you guys will drone on a little bit.
Right. He's vamping. But
as opposed to what you're doing now.
Before we get to that, yeah, well, speaking of, first we must talk about our sponsor, who is sponsoring us this week. Opportunity Days, the shared plan for regional opportunity at the University of Texas at El Paso, which is happening on May 2nd and 3rd. Okay, so let's talk about the news of the day. That would be Rick Santorum's departure, because we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, which is earlier than we usually do.
So he just left earlier this afternoon. You know, the first thing is he can't get off the ballot in Texas. He's out of the race. He said, I'm not going to run. But he's still on the Texas ballot. And in Texas, in all the polls that we have seen and polls that we have done, he's been ahead of all the other Republicans. And I don't see really anything here that would say why he fades a whole lot.
It'd be a fine how do you do if a guy who dropped out of the race won the primary.
Why do these guys use the word suspend? I mean, he says he's suspending his campaign.
Well, if Romney's hit by an asteroid, he gets to unsuspend.
Right, and they keep their campaign accounts open and they continue to collect money. In fact, somebody tweeted, right, as he was giving his speech, that right before he gave his I'm suspending my campaign speech, he sent out a fundraising email. So part of the campaign still apparently trying to generate some income.
Well,
pay some light bills.
That gets to who I think is probably the most devastated Texan of all with this news, which is Craig James, who's running for U.S. Senate. And his whole Senate message has basically been, I'm Craig James. I support Rick Santorum for president.
And so right after Santorum dropped out, there was a Craig James email that said, you know, his statement about Santorum and sorry to see him go and all that kind of stuff.
Followed by, he's been doing this series of videos in which his daughter sort of pretends to interview him, and then he responds.
She interviews him.
She interviews him.
In the same way that you pretend to host.
Fair enough.
Okay.
And I think the answers in both cases are of similar coherence. But basically, he puts out a video talking about how he's been inspired by Rick Santorum, and that's one of the reasons he's running for U.S. Senate.
Santorum's challenge to me when I got into the race and all of this kind of stuff. So
it's not a bad strategy for him to cling to Santorum, because there's not a whole lot else that differentiates him from the other guys in that race, and he's been out early and aggressively attached to Santorum. I don't think Santorum dropping out necessarily hurts him.
And Santorum could campaign for him, couldn't he, if he wanted to?
He could.
He could if he wanted to. You know, the thing this does to the ballot, though, is there's not a fight at the top of the ballot, so there's no draw for voters. You know, we've already got this delayed primary that's in May 29th, and the thought was, well, maybe the presidential race will still be a race and people will still be fighting.
That whole aspect of this just drives me bananas. If we were back in March,
right,
it would have been so significant.
It was right in the thick
of
it. Romney was wobbly, and Santorum was surging, and Texas was the Santorum state.
We lose again.
And the whole momentum thing. Well, I mean, it's interesting how it could have played, even if you ignore the fact that you're Texan for a minute. I mean, the race could have changed. If Santorum had won here and the momentum had been different, this would have been a whole different whole different thing.
I really wonder, though, if the enthusiasm for Romney in Texas, which has been tepid,
right,
suddenly increases now that he's clearly the nominee. The people who were not going to support him before decide, well, it's time to circle the wagons around the nominee and all that, and they come back and they support him. Because, as you say, it wasn't just that Santorum was up. He was up significantly.
Right. 2-1 in our last poll in February.
Well, there had been that movement afoot to change the state to winner-take-all delegate-wise in hopes that that would give his campaign a boost.
Well, in fact, Santorum mentioned this in his speech today, saying, you know, one of the things that tipped this was knowing Texas wasn't going to do that. Texas was still going to be a proportional state.
So in the end, we decided the presidential race after all. By not being winner-take-all, got out, Romney's the guy, blah-de-blah. I mean, of course, that's not really true. But
It's kind of weird, you know, because you know, in 2008, Huckabee was out of the race. McCain had already locked up the nomination when they got to Texas, and Huckabee still got 38% of the vote.
He was technically out at that point. It wasn't just a fait accompli for McCain. Huckabee was literally out.
I don't think he was campaigning.
Well, the question is Romney going to get 50%?
Right. Was that a protest 38%, or was it a
I think it just tells you something about the Republican Party in Texas.
I think it was, speaking of tepid, I think they were not thrilled about McCain.
Well, it was a social conservative from a neighboring state. They knew him. He'd been all over Texas. They knew McCain. They were sort of tepid about McCain. And, you know, McCain's the guy that had kicked Bush, right? I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons for Texas Republicans to have some animosity there. And McCain barely broke 50%. I think he got 51 and some change. And Huckabee came in right at 38.
Neither of you has brought up, you know, Ron Paul. Does this help him at all, or is he still just
Ron Paul, who's
there?
Playing up his Texan-ness all of a sudden?
Yeah, he's touring through the state this week.
I like how he's mocking Gingrich in that new ad, his moon colony guy.
Moon colony guy, yeah.
He's out there. Gingrich is out there, unlike Ron Paul.
Well, here's the thing. If Santorum is out of the race, even though he's on the ballot, if he's out of the race, not campaigning, not an active candidate, he is no longer splitting the anti-Mitt or the ABM vote. If you assume that there are anybody but Mitt voters out there, then they now only have two choices, Gingrich and Paul. And the plausibility of Gingrich and Paul is almost irrelevant because Santorum was no more plausible as the eventual nominee at this point. And certainly by May 29th, he was not going to be anyway. So maybe Santorum getting out means that some of that vote migrates to Gingrich and some migrates to Paul, and they do better than they would have done had Santorum still been in the race. I still think at the end of the day, the question is whether Romney gets a 50%. It's a symbolic victory because who cares? He's still going to be the nominee.
Is Perry still on the ballot?
Perry got off the ballot. So when they reopen the ballot because of the redistricting litigation, you have 2 or 3 days after you've filed to pull your name, sort of the, you know, buyer's remorse period, you know, the 72 hours. And I think Huntsman is still on the ballot. I think Michelle Bachmann may still be on the ballot. Rick Santorum is on the ballot. Newt Gingrich is on the ballot. Perry is off. Kane is off. So Evan just went to sleep.
It's just not as exciting an election. It's so boring now.
Well,
oh my
you know,
God.
This election, a lot of steam has come out of this thing. The U.S. Senate race is still a fight on the Republican side.
I mean, hot air.
Right. The Texas Senate race doesn't look like they're going to decide, other than for the personalities involved, much of anything. I mean, it's still going to be a little bit less than 2/3 Republican, so the control of that House isn't in play. The control of the Texas House isn't in play. Just don't snore, all right, Evan? And so you've got this kind of flat election year all of a sudden. You know, it started off really exciting. We have a Texas governor in the presidential race, and then maybe we have the presidential race coming to Texas even though the governor's out, and now it's just gone flat.
Does the lack of an exciting top of the ballot make for more tension or any excitement lower down on the ballot? Can people just step down to their local state house race and get excited about that?
No, but the game now is you have to figure out if the turnout lowers by some significant amount, who shows up in a race like that. There'll be some local races. You know,
not Evan, it looks like.
Doesn't look like Evan's going to go. But
I'm not a big primary voter anyway. So.
If you're in San Antonio and you're a Republican, there are a couple of good races. There's this Jeff Wentworth, Elizabeth Ames Jones, Donna Campbell race that's going to be noisy and expensive, and I think it's going to invade television sets all down there. There are a couple of congressional races, the Doggett race, this CD25 race that's the district that goes all the way from Fort Worth down to Hays County. So there's some pockets.
There's Gallego and Bustamante. I guess there's pockets, Strauss and Beebe, although that's not going to be a
big
race.
There's pockets of interest here, but you know, if you're in a place where there's not a local race and there's not a national race, then you sort of say who votes, and it'll be the people who always vote, which are, you know, sort of people over 60 really always vote. They vote in bond elections and school board elections and all of that, and activists. And so you have to look at your candidate and say, is this the kind of candidate that is an advantage or a disadvantage with that kind of electorate? And what do you need to do to fiddle with it? So everybody, I'm sure, now is kind of looking at their game plans for this election and saying, okay, does this still work?
Well, okay, let's move on to, like most of the presidential candidates, things that ultimately failed.
That's a nice transition there.
Yeah.
To what? Where's he going?
We're going to the schools, okay. The failing Texas schools and what they face and their struggles. Tan recently did a sort of mini documentary, not sort of, it was a mini documentary for us on this topic. And, you know, what is the situation? We're talking about two school districts specifically?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, Morgan Smith, who unfortunately is not here and is in Turkey or something.
She's on vacation.
Istanbul bureau chief.
Well, this is, you know, we did this in cooperation with Morgan based on her reporting. She put together this great four-part series looking at failing schools or failing school districts in Texas, and she spent the last week looking at two school districts that TEA has basically said over the last year, we're going to shut you down. Since then, they've both been given a one-year reprieve. So that's Premont School District in South Texas and North Forest School District in Houston. So, you know, we wanted to take a look at what's been happening in those schools. Why are they failing? Where does accountability fit into all this? And so what, you know, Justin, Dane, and I did was we put together a documentary, mini documentary. It's 13 minutes long. And, you know, there's different schools of thought on this, too, because these schools are, not only are they failing and struggling, but they're just not getting as much money as some of the wealthier and more, you know, academic, high academic performers in other districts around the state. So
that's one of the arguments made by Scott Hochberg, the outgoing.
Well, there's different schools of thought. There's different schools of thought on this. You know, you've got
vice chair, right?
You've got a legislature dominated by Republicans. You've got, you know, Rob Eisler, State Representative Rob Eisler of the Woodlands. He is a proponent of this school of thought that says, you know, we only have so much money. We need to use it better. We need to spend it better and be more careful with that. And it's all about leadership, you know, within these districts. There are examples of districts that can get high achievement with very little money. But, you know, you look at outgoing State Representative Scott Hochberg, who is very adamant about saying the state has created an unlevel or an unfair advantage for the more exemplary, which happen to be the wealthier districts that don't have very many low-income or poor students.
And that really is the point. I know that this is a huge point of discussion among people at all these conferences we all go to or speak at or, you know, whatever. Is there a correlation between per-student spending and performance? And there are people who say absolutely adamantly, no, there's no correlation, and people who say absolutely adamantly, yes. The interactive that we put up in concert with Morgan's series, when you look at the number of schools who are or districts that are rated exemplary, there does seem to be something of a correlation that
they get about $1,000 more than the students who are in that lower echelon.
The fact is that it is. I think that you hit on an important point. Only 17% of the students in those 48 districts are low income, and I think 84% of the students in the unacceptable districts are low income. And so the question is it about per student spending or is it about the socioeconomic makeup of the district?
And are those two things necessarily different? You know, there could be a correlation there too. No.
Well, you would make an assumption that, yeah, that the reason that people have more money to spend per student is because the districts are wealthier. But you know, there's supposed to be an evening out of that, right?
That's why all the school districts have gone to court, because right, the evening out, you know, periodically the evening out doesn't even things out. Falls out of balance, and so a bunch of school districts are suing the state and saying, you know, you're not providing the same amount of funding, and more specifically, you're not providing everybody equal access to the same level of education because of that funding.
It comes back to political clout as well, and Hochberg emphasizes again and again during our interview. I didn't emphasize it too much in the documentary, but he talks about how, you know, these wealthy districts are politically very influential. They like where they're at, and all of these districts in the middle who are acceptable don't want to fall any lower, so they also are not very apt to fight, you know, against the system and demand more funding for the poorest districts around the state.
Now, Robert Scott, the TEA commissioner, did not sit for an interview for this mini-doc. Why do you think that is?
Well, I'm not going to venture to guess. They didn't give us a reason. They basically said, well, we'll check into this, and then they never called us back. Morgan, you know, took the added step of calling them and, you know, asking them again, and they basically said he
was
not
going
to be
available.
What
do you think TEA's position on,
well, this is a very
on this correlation
question? It's a political issue, and when you're talking about closing districts, bottom line is no commissioner wants to talk about it because these communities get very upset. I mean, this affects their, you know, economic outlook, lots of families, generations that have been going to these schools. Nobody wants to touch it. I mean,
couldn't he have come on and said something sort of along the lines of what Eisler said? You know, it's about leadership and it's about getting good people in the.
Well, he could have come on to talk about,
which is sort of a soft response, I think.
But Eisler's not in a position of being the guy who's going to pull the trigger on this. I think Robert Scott's probably being cautious and, you know, doesn't want to say anything now that's going to look different in a different light when he does or doesn't close this place.
Well, they're already backtracking in a way because they're giving both of these districts
a reprieve.
Right. So
that's true. Well, although the Premont superintendent had to achieve what in Texas seems like the impossible, he had to persuade the community that giving up sports for a year to keep the schools open was a good thing. And I think that's, you know, he needs to have a food taster, I suspect, for the next year.
Right.
Did he have to persuade the community, or did he just have to tell the community?
Well, whether you tell the community and then backfill it by persuading them.
Right.
Because what happens is they end up running you out of town with pitchforks and torches. I mean, it's not like he had to go get the community to vote on this, but having made the decision, he certainly had to persuade the community this was the right course to pursue.
What's interesting is when Morgan and Justin went down there to, you know, interview him, he said he had not received any complaints about this. There have been no public movements against him for making this decision. And I think it's because they know that this is a pretty bad situation.
Well, it's about how you frame it, right? Which one of the things I thought was interesting is that, you know, if you can successfully create this sort of buy-in among the students that they need to save the school, which, you know, was sort of touched on in the documentary, then, you know, maybe it can work. And if you say, okay, you are losing sports, you can bring it back if you guys all come to school for the next year.
Let me relate to you something that happened last week in Odessa when I was at University of Texas of the Permian Basin with Tom Craddock and Kel Seliger and Tryon Lewis. Somebody got up during the question and answer portion of this event and said, look, there were three school districts out this way. Didn't say exactly where they were, but they were obviously rural school districts, small schools. And each district had a superintendent, and each district was not performing adequately. And they all are strapped for cash because that's the way the world is these days. And this person said, why don't we consolidate these three districts, combine the schools under one umbrella, one set of administration, save money and all that. And, you know, that's just blasphemy. In a lot of these communities, the idea of closing schools or consolidating school districts or what have you, it's a loss of jobs. It's a loss of pride. And in some places, it's a case where, from a sports standpoint, they get nervous that their ability to stand out among the pack is going to be diminished because they're going to be absorbed into this other, you know, this other world.
But at the same time, for the students, couldn't it mean a chance to go to a better school district?
They don't really see that.
The community in that room, as reflected by the people in that room, did not seem to be buying that argument.
And you know, Morgan reported on Wilmer Hutchins ISD. They were shut down several years ago, and it's taken what, 5 or 6 years for them to be fully absorbed into the, you know, Dallas Independent School District. Yep. And there's still lingering feelings because they used to be rivals. And, you know, I mean, there was a lot of pride that was involved. And looking at some of the news coverage then too, I just think that, you know, kids are kids, and all they know is I ride the bus to school with my friend, and now she's going to a different school. You know,
well, and kids are only there for a minute. This took 5 years. You're only in high school for 4 years. I mean, this,
well, it depends.
I mean, well, this was Reeve accepted. I mean, this was disruptive to their high school experience. You know, they, you know, whether they were there for, you know, this was going all 4 years while they were in high school, or worse, if you got halfway in and it changed, or, you know, it's just tough.
But it also means that, you know, it won't be long before this will be the way it's always been for the kids.
Yeah, but that's assuming that they've been absorbed into a school district that's turned it into a good school as opposed to the school it was before. I mean, there's a whole bunch of assumptions there. I mean, it makes everybody, you know, sort of in the accountability business feel better that they closed a school district that wasn't performing. But it'll be interesting to go back 4 or 5 years later and see if they've created a school district, if they just moved the problem or if they solved it.
Or eventually will just be one giant consolidated school district called Texas.
Right. Can I just say, I'm so amazed, though, because I don't think I realized, like, Eisler brought it up, and, you know, when he said that 1 in 10 American school children is a Texan, I mean, that's just, that is a huge task to educate them.
We are big and, you know, disproportionately impact everything out in the world, and we also absorb the lion's share of the problems that the rest of the world divides among other places. It's crazy.
Well, it's one of the reasons why Texas school districts are so interesting, I think, and also because we have such a high Hispanic population, which is a population that has struggled with education attainment historically. It's a good place to try out new things. So if you do have good leadership and you're willing to, you know, really experiment. Some people have had great. I mean, you have like Dan King, Far San Juan Alamo, who used to be over at Hidalgo. I mean, a lot of interesting things are happening in Texas, but again, as well as some sad things.
But I think that one of the consequences of these cuts is that a lot of the money that was available to innovate, where the mandate to these guys was try a bunch of cool stuff in service to greatness, and if it doesn't work out, we're not going to get too freaked out about it. That money is not there now. The money was there. So the Danny Kings of the world, what are they going to do? I mean, they have all the ideas in the world, but if they don't have the resources to pull it off, it's a problem. And it's exactly the moment when people have to try new things because we're out of choices. The conventional thing's not working.
But these are two separate issues, too, right? Accountability is one thing. We've already had issues with that. We've had funding problems probably since, I think, 2006 is when the property tax thing changed. And
well, we've had the first school finance mess was solved, quote unquote, in 1948. It's been around for a while.
So it's been around for a while. But then you add the $4 billion education cut. I mean, isn't that a whole separate, that's a whole nother problem where we don't even foresee or know yet what the consequences are of that.
Well, Bill Ratliff, the former lieutenant governor and former Senate finance chairman, says that the accumulated cuts over the last 4 years are much, much larger than that. And the problem with this is that you can restore that money, but you still lost whatever you lost during those 4 years. I mean, you know, if this kid didn't get that component of his or her education, they still didn't get it 4 years later. I mean, you may get the kid behind them, but, you know, you create these pockets of kids that for one reason or another didn't get everything from the education system they were supposed to get.
Well, and that's what's sort of troubling about losing sports somewhere like Premont ISD, right? Because we'll just get rid of it for a year, but then that year's up and you're like, well, we don't have tons of money to bring it back.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So anything, that's sort of a downer note to...
But you're in charge here.
Was there anything hopeful in the documentary?
No.
But it was a very realistic, frankly, it was a realistic look at what's going on, you know. And the more you don't sugarcoat it, the better off we all are because people understand the stakes.
And, you know, and it really has, it has brought that community together. And, you know, private entities have stepped up and, you know, donated money to the district. Parents are getting more and more involved. You've got the principal, the constable, the superintendent going out and knocking on doors.
I thought that was really interesting in the doc, that the superintendent Singleton of Premont was out with the constable essentially trying to round kids up because the attendance rate in the district was not at the level it needed to be to satisfy the TEA.
It's like an old school truant officer,
was
wasn't it?
It was
low, and we don't know what's going to happen. And they go out there and they talk to parents who are like, "I don't know where my child is. I can't control him or her." I mean, Morgan says that's the cultural change that's going to be the most difficult thing for them to try to change. And so, I think it's going to be a fascinating story to.
But I do think that the concept of, you know, sort of being allowed to fail or sort of having to face that threat of failure to sort of give you a kickstart, which sort of that crops up in the debate a lot.
Well, it might still happen. These two districts may not make it. We'll see.
So let's get to our third surprise topic, since we have a few minutes. This new conservative group called
Texas Conservative Roundtable.
They put out their first ever scorecard this morning. Yesterday morning or Tuesday morning, depending on which day you listen to this.
You know, there are a bunch of groups on the left and on the right and in the middle and on every special interest that do scorecards, where they take the legislature's votes. Usually they take some subset of votes that they are most interested in and score the legislators accordingly. And, you know, this new group that started up just recently has put out a scorecard for conservatives that differs markedly from the scorecards from other conservative groups, whether they're the Young Conservatives of Texas, Texans for Fiscal Responsibility, or even groups like, you know, the Texas Association of Business. There are some names that you ordinarily see at the top of these lists that you don't necessarily see at the top of the list from the Texas Conservative Roundtable.
Who are the people? The most interesting.
Kel Seliger, conservative.
Well, I think the most interesting is that David Simpson and Pete Gallego are about tied.
That's pretty interesting.
Both in the mid-60s.
Well, and they had, you know, Chuy Hinojosa, who's a Democrat, at 92%.
Amazingly conservative.
Had him with a 92. You know, a couple of names that jumped out at me just as examples. You can go look at the whole list on their website, but the and there's a link from the story on our website to all of these lists. Brian Birdwell and Ken Paxton, who are generally considered among the most conservative members of the Texas legislature, and I'll give you a cite for that in a second, were in the second tier on this list. Kel Seliger and Todd Smith, who generally aren't at the top end of the conservative rankings, were at the top end of the conservative rankings on this. Now, if you pick the right votes, you can, you know, move everybody to the top that you want to move to the top. But it was kind of interesting.
Who are the people behind this group?
You know, they haven't released their donors yet. Brian Hebert, who used to work for Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, and Julie Carruthers Parsley, who's a lawyer who's been around Austin for a long
time. Was she on the PUC appointed by Perry?
On the PUC appointed by Perry. She's a former assistant AG under either Cornyn or Abbott or both. Anyway, you know, there's this ongoing battle inside the Republican Party, as we've talked about over and over again, you know, between sort of establishment Republicans and movement conservatives, you know, however you want to, you know, whatever terms you want to use. There are some fractures in the party, and they're all coming evident in these, in sort of the battle over these, over these rankings.
So there is conservatism basically, or liberalism, you know, these labels are basically just in the eye of the beholder. Isn't that sort of the takeaway from
you know
this?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on which vote you pick. If you, you know, if you pick these five votes and rank everybody according to those, you'll get a different ranking than if you pick those five votes and rank everybody according to that. We did this thing, or actually we ran this thing that Mark Jones from Rice University did. He's the head of the political science department there. And he took all of the votes and ranked all of the members of the House, all of the members of the Senate according to their votes on a scale and said this one's more conservative than that one. So it was a relative scale within each chamber over time. And if you compare the Texas Conservative Roundtable's list of conservative voting with his rankings of voting on all the votes instead of selected votes, it doesn't match up exactly. In fact, his list doesn't match up exactly with anybody's list, which is kind of interesting. You know, it tells you something about the quality of the scorecard, or the nature of the scorecard is determined by which votes the legislature made that you picked to rank them on. If you rank them on how they voted for speaker, you'll get one result. If you get on how they voted for the budget, you might get another result.
Is there just like no room for nuance anymore? I mean, as a politician.
Well, everybody's looking for binaries. Everybody's looking for you are either with us or against us,
yeah,
and here's the measure of it, right? And so everybody's looking for a black and white measure, and it is all gray. I mean, that's the nature of politics and the nature of legislating and all of that kind of stuff.
Are they meant to influence these lawmakers to vote a certain way or to actually influence the voters and the constituents?
Well, now you're getting into the Empower Texas lobbying question.
They're not the only ones who do this.
Right, exactly.
They're meant to influence lawmakers to vote a certain way for fear that what those scorecards say will cause voters not to reelect them.
Yeah, vote this way or we'll tell voters you didn't. And if we're right and you're wrong, the voters will throw you out. If you're right and we're wrong, the voters will throw away the scorecard.
So is there an ethics complaint coming against the Conservative Roundtable for lobbying?
Not yet. I mean, they haven't been in existence during a session yet. So, no.
And part of it is direct communication with lawmakers.
On issues that the lawmakers are voting on. And the lawmakers aren't voting on anything right now, aren't deciding anything right now. I think this whole ethics complaint, we talked about a little bit last week, this whole ethics complaint against Empower Texans and Texans for Fiscal Responsibility is going to make everybody in that business at least check their work, right? Go back and look at, are we doing everything correctly here? TFN and Empower Texans, of course, maintain that they haven't done anything wrong and that there's nothing to change. But I think everybody in that business is, you know, making sure everything's just so.
But don't you think, though, do you think that, you know, the variance in these lists sort of you know, illustrates the problem with, you have these boring campaigns where people just go and say, I'm going to go to the Capitol to vote, you know, the most conservative way possible. And it sort of doesn't mean anything.
You know, you walk down the cereal aisle in the grocery store and you say, you know what, all these things say they're healthy, but I don't have any idea what's in them, right? Every box says the same thing on it. And it's like that with politics. You do that and everybody says, I'm a conservative. I hate those people that you hate. I like those people that you like. And you go, I don't really know what the contents are. So all of these are efforts to tell you what the contents of those politicians are. And if you can find one that you agree with, if you always agree with this group and they rate this person top rated, then you can be reasonably sure you can vote that way. But it's all a matter of, you know, which group is really conservative in my own way, you know, and it comes down to, I mean, the best thing here would probably be pick the issues that you really care about, you know, put them on a list, see how all the legislators voted on the issues that you care about, and you have your own personal scorecard, and you're good to go.
Or you could just eat cereal.
Actually, the cereal industry did have a scandal where people were buying to get, like, healthy check marks on their boxes, right?
Right. Exactly right.
This has spun totally out of control.
You had no idea cereal was all politics, did you?
You mean the scorecard industry that's out of control?
Kel's Special K Seliger, is that what we're going to call him?
We should mention while we're here that you're going to have Hochberg and Eisler.
I will have Scott Hochberg and Rob Eisler together at Trib Live at the Austin Club, 7:30 in the morning on April 26th, and I will ask them piercing questions of the Tauntaun variety. And I may actually ask them which cereal they are.
You know? Do you have any predictions?
Hochberg strikes me.
If you were a tree.
Hochberg is kind of like Goline Crunch, wouldn't you say, kind of healthy? Eisler is kind of like Lucky Charms. He's magically delicious, right?
No.
Keep up.
No. I was just, yeah.
I hope he's listening. I hope you heard that.
He probably has some pun about that ready to go.
When I'm sure he already does.
Yeah, right.
Nope. If you have a pun or a question or a comment, you can email it to tribcast@texastribune.org. In the meantime, on behalf of Evan, Ross, Ton, our producer Todd, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Is it over yet? Are we done?